Wow. Good morning. Good morning. It's the glorious 4th. The glorious 4th. Actually, you know, for all intents and purposes, it should have been the glorious 2nd. But like always in history, we, you know, kind of change things a little bit. Nothing too serious. Hey, this is the 4th of July. It's time to blow your fingers off. It's KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial, 231-8187. It is talk radio. It is me, Joe Uris. Abe is off today. So we're going to talk about a bunch of stuff. I have so much material, and I'm going to actually do a little lecturing. You're going to have to put up with that. You know, it'll be, I don't know if it'll be funny, but it'll be interesting. I want to talk about a bunch of stuff. An article by George Lakoff and others that has been making its way around the web. Many of you may have seen it. An article by Jane Mayer in The New Yorker, most recent edition. And an article from the U.S. News and World Report, great conservative publication, talking about James Addington, as does Jane Mayer. So, a lot of stuff to talk about, and I'm hoping you all will stick around because it's important stuff. It really is important stuff. And it goes to the heart of the analysis that needs to be made about our time and our situation. First of all, little history thing. The United States was founded essentially, and this is not a criticism, it's actually a kind of a positive thing. The United States was created as a nation of landholders. The idea of a freehold, of the yeoman farmer, deeply embedded in the consciousness of such elitists and, in most cases, slaveholders as Thomas Jefferson. But with the idea that these persons, that is, persons with real investment in the land, would become the citizens who would run and manage the society. Through time, the Constitution of the United States expanded the definition of who could vote, expanding it all the way through women, non-holders of land, and eventually even persons of color. This is a triumph, and it is interesting because the United States is the earliest, the youngest, of surviving democracies of significance in the modern world. And because it is the youngest and because it is the earliest, there are problems that would later be rectified in other democracies that are still part of our constitutional system. For example, the Electoral College. Just one small example. But I want to talk about what's going on in America today. I really want to make, I think, a rational argument that many of us are missing in some aspects. Not all of us are missing all aspects. Some of us have a better understanding than others. But all of us need to think about these aspects. First of all, the assumption that a lot of us make, because it's so tempting, that George Bush is incompetent, is an interesting idea. Now, the question of whether George himself is bright or not is not the point here. George clearly is not the smartest, the smallest egg in the dozen. That's not an expression, is it? Anyway, no, George is not. But in an article by George Lakoff from Berkeley and Mark Ettlinger and Sam Ferguson for the Brockridge Institute, published on Monday the 26th, the argument is made basically that Bush's disasters, Katrina, the Iraq War, the budget deficit, are not incompetent or failures of execution, which they are in one level, but they're also natural, even inevitable results of the conservative governing philosophy. The idea that Bush is incompetent is a curious one, because you have to, and I'm quoting a lot here from this article, you have to consider the following incomplete list of major initiatives that the Bush administration with loyal conservative Congress has accomplished. And you have to consider this in the context of a Democratic Party which has offered no coherent political philosophy in opposition. And by the way, the reason why that is the case historically, in the formal sense, is because you had, previous to the Bush administration, a conservative, a la Tony Blair, left party, center-right, really, party, the Democratic Party, in power in Washington prior to this. First of all, centralizing power within the executive branch to an unprecedented degree, the idea of the unitary presidency. This is key philosophically and in terms of the activities of this present government. Bush has been able to start two major wars. One, the Iraq War, started with questionable intelligence in a manner which the military actually disagreed with, placing on the Supreme Court two far-right justices and stacking the lower courts, which may even be more important, with many, many more far-right people. Cutting taxes during wartime. This is unprecedented. Never, ever had this happened in our country's history. Passing a number of controversial bills such as the Patriot Act, the No Child Left Behind Act, the Medicare drug bill, the bankruptcy, and a number of massive tax cuts, all of which are designed to strip the government of its significant role as a helper, that is, a provider of services to the public, and increase the government's power over our lives. Rolling back and refusing to enforce a host of basic regulatory protections, which essentially transfers from the protection of the commonweal, of us, of our government, a number of things into the hands of opportunistic, short-sighted, and one must say, extremely greedy land exploiters. Appointing industry officials to oversee all of the regulatory agencies. And what does that mean? When you put the fox in charge of the hen house, you know the inevitable outcome. Establishing a greater role for religion through faith-based initiatives, drawing into government notions that are primarily of a certain type of Christianity. Passing Orwellian-titled legislation. What do I mean by Orwellian? Well, George Orwell in 1984 talked about legislation that meant the opposite of what it said. For example, the Healthy Forest Act, the Clean Skies Initiative, essentially which deforests public lands and put more pollution in our skies. Finally, winning re-election and solidifying his party's grip in Congress through actual corruption and fraud in the electoral process in two major national elections. Now, Laycock and so on argue that this is not incompetence. The Bush administration has been overwhelmingly competent in advancing its conservative vision. Overwhelmingly confident. It has been all too effective in achieving its goals by undermining, pursuing a conservative philosophy. Now, it's not Bush. It's not Bush. It's the agenda and the people behind the agenda. This conservative philosophy has three fundamental tenets. Individual initiative, that is, government's positive role in people's lives outside of the military and police, should be minimized. That's the old, idea of, Grover Norquist, drowning the government, making it so small you can drown it in the bathtub. That's an actual quote. Police should be minimized. President is the moral authority, and the free market is enough to foster freedom and opportunity. Now, never mind the concept of what exactly you mean by a free market, but you only have to look at China to understand how nonsensical that one is. So, if this argument is right, then the failure of the government to take care of Katrina, the failure of the government to deal with the environment, the failure of the government even to deal with the danger to our ports from these radical Islamicists, all of that is simply part of a structural change that convinces you and I that the government is incompetent and therefore makes us turn our attention away from expectations that the government can protect us or can help us or can do good for us and leaves us in a position of absolute resentment of government. Let's look at it as a positive, let's look at it as a kind of a small example. You go to a state park anywhere in the United States today. Used to be that state park was free. Now you pay a fee. How do you feel when you pay that fee? Do you feel like, oh, well, I'm contributing to the survival of this given the government has cut back monies? No. 9 times out of 10, particularly if you're a working person, you look at this and you say, damn, here's another fee that I have to pay. I really hate the government. See how it works? It's real simple. So when the government disregards the Katrina warnings, when the government turns contracts over to Blackwater, when the government has Halliburton stealing left and right, on one level it's incompetent, yes. But on another level, it's incredibly strategically brilliant because it convinces everyone in America not to trust government, which suits the absolute interests and the absolute needs of these Norquistians. Get it? And then the budget deficit. The budget deficit is a brilliant strategy because it makes sure, we first saw this in the Reagan administration, by the way, makes sure that there's not going to be monies to do social democratic reforms. Universal health care, out the window. Decent educational systems, K through college and university, out the window. Real repair of the environment, out the window. Why? Because we won't be able to afford them because we'll be servicing a debt that will be so enormous. So enormous. And this is the strategy of this administration. So, where does this all come from? Well, it comes from several sources, but the Project for a New American Century, signed in 97, is a who's who of the architects of the war. Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Zalmay Khalilzad, I. Lewis Libby, and many others, and we're going to talk about some of those others in a minute, who argue that we need, and these are 4 points, we need to increase defense spending significantly if we are to carry out our global responsibilities and modernize our armed forces for this future. We need to strengthen our ties to democratic allies and to challenge regimes hostile to our interests and values. We need to promote the cause of political and economic freedom abroad. Now, this is their language. We need to accept responsibility for America's unique role in preserving and extending an international order friendly to our security, our prosperity, and our principles. Implicit in these ideas is that the United States military can spread democracy through the barrel of a gun. Our military might and power can and should be a force for good. Now, everyone gets hung up, well, is it about oil? You know, is Iraq about oil? Is it about... Listen, it doesn't matter. Yes, it's about oil. That's not the key point. The key point is we're building an empire. We're going to have permanent bases in that region if we can get away with it. We may be withdrawing troops in an ironic way, but we will always have these hardened bases, these hardened landing fields, to supply our troops to be able to protect our interests in oil in the region. At the same time, rivalries develop. The former Soviet Union, Russia, quickly begins to see the dangers of this and designs its own pipeline to go through its own pristine forests to bring oil to the Pacific coast so it can work with the world markets. The real motive behind the Iraqi war wasn't to stop Iraq's pursuit of weapons of mass destruction. We all know that now. But essentially, it was a test. Pardon me, of the neoconservative theory that the United States military could reshape Middle East geopolitics. What stands in the way of that, of course, is the reality of the Middle East. But this is important. This is important. You must understand. This is not defeat. Bush's administration, forget Bush himself, is not stupid. In fact, even the language that Bush is using, the kind of rhetorical language he uses, is designed to appeal to the most basic, simple-minded of us who are most cynical about the role of government. The calling up of kind of conservative values and commingling those with religious values and then overwashing that with a kind of genuine extreme patriotism plays well in a society that has always played well with patriotism. Remember always in school how you used to learn to pledge allegiance to the United States. So I think you get the idea. The point is that what's happened is not an accident. It is not incompetence per se, though there's much incompetence in it. It is a strategic plan to make the government less accessible, make it less trustworthy, and make us more and more willing to go with an anti-government stance, and to make our debt so huge that it can, in the process of being served, we can never, ever, ever developed social democratic reforms, national health care, better unemployment insurance, better retirement programs, better child care programs, better education, and so on, and so on, and so on. Now, who is the great designer of all of this? Well, I don't want to get conspiratorial, but an article in the U.S. News and World Report, a conservative, business-oriented national news magazine, talks about James Addington, a guy you may or may not have heard of, who was Cheney's, you know, Vice President Cheney's chief of staff, who has pushed, along with you and others, the unitary presidency theory, which says basically in a time of crisis, the president can do anything to protect America. Now, this is really what lies behind this in structural terms. And in a larger sense, the scary part of all this, folks, is that we are increasingly dependent upon a process in which monies are being leveraged throughout the world, and the vulnerability of the United States is not simply in resistance in places like Iraq or in our kind of uncritical support of Israel. No. The real problem is the fact the United States is so financially overextended and that it is in markets over which nobody has any real control or understanding, which could easily force us into a runaway inflation, which would make your and my incomes effectively go down and down and down into the cellar, into the hell of things. Okay? Now, I want to give opportunity to our callers. I've set things up. I'll come back to these themes a little later. But this is not the funniest show I've ever done. It's one of the most serious. And I want serious conversation. I don't necessarily want super regular callers. I want new voices. I want to hear from women. And I want to hear from people who disagree with what I'm saying. I want this to be a dialogue. I want you to participate in it. I want us all to be talking on July 4th about the future of America before we go and blow our fingers off. So, talk radio, Joe Uris, KBOO 90.7, the number to call, 231-8187, and let's go out to Jeff.
Good morning, Joe. Your analysis is really brilliant.
Thank you.
Clinton was, as you say, really a Republican. And look now over the past 10, 15 years, and China opens up economically, whereas to join the economic global order.
Uh-huh.
And America tightens its freedoms like China has its tightened freedoms. So ultimately, China and the United States are the same animal. And we talk about Independence Day. I mean, we've never been more less independent as a nation, as a people, as individuals with our consumer credit than we are now. And I'm afraid that Mr. Clinton and Mr. Bush and all of these, Mr. Kissinger even, all the way back, and the Chinese ruling whoever they are.
Yeah, well, I would even say Kissinger is a war criminal.
Collusion.
Yeah. No, I think
that's what Russia fears, of course.
Yeah, I think, and the Russians, rightly, I'm afraid, consider us as, again, their enemy. A new Cold War is developing, the competition over land and, of course, oil.
Fuel,
you bet.
Energy of all kinds.
Yes.
Why do you think we have this energy man in the White House and the energy man at the Naval Academy where the vice president lives? Allegedly.
Allegedly.
The heartless man.
Allegedly. The troglodyte.
But it seems to me that as China opens its economy more, and we clamp down on our freedoms more, you see, suddenly it's a level playing field of a universal anthill that's run by the termites, I guess, the soldiers, and then the queen plays those eggs out and just keeps popping them out. And we all become mere workers that aren't organized, you know, but we're just enslaved by the most important thing, like you say, the most important thing that we're enslaved by as individuals and as societies is credit. It is money. It is indebtedness.
Exactly. And this is very important.
That's the enemy of the Declaration of Independence is this indebtedness.
You know, I'm glad you're saying that because it's very, very important. One of the theories that I remember from way back, I mean, we're talking like 1960, that long ago, most of you weren't even alive. But way back at that time in history, I can remember people like Michael Harrington of the old Socialist Party you know, anti-communist socialists, saying that they saw the Sovietization of American society and the Americanization of Soviet society in the same sense that we're talking about how China and the United States come closer to closer as they become more and more a madly consumer-oriented culture. And
highly leveraged as well.
Yeah, highly leveraged as well. Now, China.
Well,
happy
Independence Day, Joe. Thanks for listening to me.
Thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate the call. Now, this question of leverage, this question of debt, remember that the nations that hold the United States in debt, and therefore hold a lot of cards in the game, include Russia, include China, particularly include China. And this is crucial to understanding the situation that we're in right now. This government definitely believes in bankrupting the U.S. government for both political, you know, theoretical, ideological ends, and at the same time believes that this is a safe course of action to take. It's amazing. And the other thing I haven't yet mentioned is the simple fact of the transfer of wealth in this society from working people, whether they're middle class or upper middle class or lower working class or regular working class, the transfer of wealth from those people through taxation changes and other forms of taxes and so on, the transfer of that wealth from you and I to the most wealthy, most powerful, most opportunistic, and most ambitious corporate wealth holders. This is really important. It's got to be appreciated, and it's got to be understood in its entire meaning. But I want to point out something that a lot of people don't remember. One day, some years ago, I was invited, because I had attacked him, to his credit, on Lars Larson's show, the old right-winger Lars Larson. And he said to me, in a great sneering voice, where is it in the Constitution that the government is supposed to give the American people anything? It's supposed to help the American people. And I remembered, fortunately, on account of how I teach this stuff, the preamble of the Constitution, which says, we, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare. I want to repeat that one. Promote the general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Do ordain and establish the Constitution of the United States of America. And then, through a process both of the Constitution itself and history, we have evolved a system which has increased voter participation, increased the rights of individuals, men, women, men without property, women, African Americans, and so on. But moreover, the notion established by the courts under Marshall way back when of the absolute separation of the various powers of government and the right of the courts to review the laws in terms of their constitutional relevance and importance. This is crucial. And all of this under this idea of a unitary presidency where the president has absolute power because we're in a state of emergency. And by the way, when you're on a war against drugs or a war against terror, there, because it's a reification, you know, not a real thing treated as if it is, the war is endless, therefore the crisis is endless, therefore the inevitable consequence is a kind of friendly, not so friendly for many people, but friendly fascism built around fear of amorphous enemies that cannot be combated by the very methods we are using. And I want to point out, too, that it is peculiarly the case that the government has spent a lot of money making sure your shoes don't have explosives in them when you go on an airplane and investigating your background and checking your emails and so on, and very little effort on securing the ports of the United States and making this country, in other words, in practical terms, a safe country, very little dealing with the issue of global warming, which this administration still is in profound denial about. This is crucial. It's not an accident. They're not stupid. That's Laycock's point. They're ambitious for a new kind of vision, which essentially puts all responsibility on the hands of individuals as if everybody not only were born equal in the abstract sense, but had the same hunk of change at the beginning of their lives. And all the evidence points out the fact that actually wealth is very unequally distributed in the United States and has become increasingly unequally distributed. Now, I want to be clear here. I am not opposed to free enterprise if you can find it. I think starting new businesses, I think inventing new products, I think that the kind of energy that that provokes and promotes is an important thing. But just as there needs to be checks and balances in the Constitution, there must be checks and balances to the power of money. And the checks and balances to the power of money must rest in the people, and the people's representatives have to be the Congress of the United States, since it clearly is not going to be the president. And where is that Congress today? Well, it's hiding. It's chicken. It's cowardly. It's afraid to take on this powerful machine of propaganda, lies, distortions, confusions, and terrors. So, happy July 4th. We do want to hear from you. It is Talk Radio, 231-8187. Be not afraid. Speak up. If you disagree, all the better, because I'm ready for it. I'm not going to yell at you, and I'm not going to mistreat you. I hope I won't lose my temper. And if you agree with me or have another take on this, hey, this is your opportunity to speak out, because this is America's birthday. Happy birthday to America. Happy birthday to America. We hope you don't destroy the world. Happy birthday to America. Okay. Oh, man, I have had such a week, I have to tell you. I am now joining the ranks of the cripples because I managed to break my arm. I wasn't going to tell you this, but it's true. Break my arm in two places. And discovering, it's very interesting, discovering what it's like in this society to be a, you know, one-wing person. Of course, the arm I broke was my one I use most, my right arm. It's very interesting. The world is not rigged for folks with one arm, and this is relevant to something else entirely, which is the number of American men and women, loyal, perhaps naive, but very faithful, very believing, who go over to a place like Iraq or Afghanistan and come home limbless or broken or damaged, either psychologically, and that's very common, or actually physically. And the fact is that the government, this government, has consistently cut the money for exactly those kinds of people. It's just another example of this making government so irrelevant, so small, so distrusted, that we all sit around idly watching the entertainment that is provided by seeing that government drowned in the bathtub of the new age in America. All right, got other calls. Lots of them. 231-8187. Jay, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I'm concerned about the end timers.
The end timers.
In the administration, like Karl Rove and Bush himself. You know, that whole Midland, Texas, Sugarland, Texas.
Hello. You have to turn down your radio. I think you have a radio on. See, we have a new system that keeps obscenities from happening, so you have to turn down your radio. Can you do that?
Yeah. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's much better. Yeah, I will address that, because that's very important. It's very important.
It is. It's little recognized. Like, the faith-based initiative is very insidious.
Right. There are two things going on simultaneously, and two great constituencies being served right now by this administration. The rest of us, including a lot of supporters of it, are simply the victims of this process. But those two constituencies are a new kind of religious fundamentalism. By the way, it didn't even exist until the late 1800s and didn't become important until the 20th century. And this new kind of constituency looks toward a biblical interpretation of St. John the Divine, of what's called the Book of the Apocalypse, which essentially argues. And by the way, this has always been a theme of Christianity from the time of the death of Jesus to now, that Jesus is coming soon, that he's going to bring to earth, it depends on interpretation, either a great new country with only saved people, or that people float up to heaven and the process takes place in that context. Added to that is the argument about whether or not this rapture, this floating up of presumably naked folks, comes before or after the great last war between satanic forces and the forces of good. This is a serious belief system. This has been around for quite some time, and it has grown in popularity. Can
you hear me?
Yeah.
You know, if you have that end time perspective on things, you tend to ignore the needs of people who are low income, who are disabled, who are elderly, who have little voice in the system. The safety net, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I'm low income myself. I'm very concerned as I age about how my needs are going to be met when all the money is going to, the military.
No, I think it's a reasonable concern.
It is. It's huge.
I think one strategy that has to be carried out by even the poorest of us now in self-defense, this is not to get the government off the hook, but it's just in self-interest. Every one of us has to set aside, and I would say ideally, even if we're impoverished, 30% of every hard cash dollar we have in something safe. Now, that brings up another problem, which of course is that our money, our currency, is about to undergo a horrible inflation because of the situation.
Good point.
Of the situation. And I don't have a solution to that. I know there are gold bugs out there, you know, buy gold, blah, blah, blah. It's a very difficult situation. But this is something that we have to do in our own self-protection. We also have to refuse to abandon the psychological notion that we won't be taken care of. Even as we save for our retirements and our old age and our emergency needs.
Yeah, when the money means nothing, you're lost.
Yeah, but even under those circumstances, we have to keep that saving going. And at the same time, we have to demand Social Security reform. Not the reform of these guys who would throw our money into the hands of the markets, but rather that the system that does exist needs to be strengthened and made more rational, and that everyone should be able to participate in it. But one of the other things that I wanted to bring up is the degree to which this government is able to pull off distractions, mm-hmm. one after another, that totally...
From human needs.
Right, exactly. Distractions from reality and from human needs. The war in Iraq is one such distraction, even though it has other purposes.
Like the 4th of July fireworks.
Well, the 4th of July fireworks are a common and small distraction, but larger distractions are the terrible fear of terrorists, which we don't really deal with, but which creates for us, as Bush would say, 9-11, heh-heh, 9-11, heh-heh. You know, the fact of the matter is that we are being distracted to death, television engaged in this activity, the wanton degree of violence. You realize we have more violence on television, which is fine for kids to watch, than we have lovemaking, which is no-no. And I'm not, urging the lovemaking. That's not my point. My point is that essentially we create a culture in which we watch television and think of the world as extremely dangerous at the same time that we're not dealing with the causes of that dangerousness. So
right.
We tend to become very reactionary. Let's build more prisons. A dead-ender thing. It's one of many examples
of this. That's a huge separate thing. Lock them up.
Yeah.
The lock them up mentality.
Exactly. But I think the struggle is worth engaging in. In fact, I have to say this. We have no choice. It isn't like, should I participate in politics? No. It doesn't, you may not succeed. There's the existential reality that you do something whether or not you're going to succeed because it's the right thing to do. But if you don't do that, then you are a participant actively in a political structure that is potentially ever more fascistic. This is really cruel, but it's really crucial. And it's hard for people to understand. Anyone who says, I'm not political, I don't vote, is making an important political statement.
Well, they're saying that because
they
can afford to say it.
Well, no, they're saying it because they may, it's a lot of reasons, but they may misunderstand. The reality is non-participation is the most significant political statement of our time, and more voters turn away from the polls. Now, people say, well, look at the choices. You got your right-wing Republicans, and you got your right-wing Democrats. Yes, but of those, you have to look around for what there is available. And on the local level, it becomes extremely significant, and even on the national level. Now, does that mean that they won't rig the elections like I honestly believe they did in 2000 and 2004? They probably will, just like they probably rigged the Mexican election just now, if you've been paying attention to that one.
Exactly.
But the struggle, the voices, the activities, the range of opportunities from writing letters to editors to doing civil disobedience to carrying out large demonstrations, to making small statements, to struggling, I would say, at the minimum for 8 hours every week, is virtuous, important, and because I always believe there's a tipping point, a point where people don't buy it anymore, you know, you never know where that's going to be. You never know how it's going to come. The more you participate, the more you're ready for that moment.
I was watching Bernanke, you know, Ben Bernanke, the new head of the Fed, talking about the debt, and basically he was talking about approaching that tipping point where our, you know, our country is no longer of interest to investors on the outside.
Right.
And like what the person was saying about indebtedness, we're basically an indebted society, and you know that our money is going to become meaningless, and the people like myself who are aging are going to be really caught and lost, and that really scares me. And that's, you know, the real human needs are not being considered by this administration. They're concerned about these grandiose, you know, that new American century mentality of Cheney and Wolfowitz and Pearl and all those guys is just unbelievable.
And James Addington. James Addington, a name we all need to learn.
Exactly.
This is important.
Because I read that Jane Mayer piece, and it was brilliant.
Yeah.
He's just a cold-blooded. I mean, that's what scares me.
Now, there's another aspect to this, which is that I'm speaking to an audience, by and large, of the converted, one way or another. They may be conspiracists or whatever, but basically they sort of agree with me. The right-wing talk show hosts who have larger audiences speak to an audience who is of a similar mind in the sense of their belief systems. There is, unfortunately, no true, reasonable dialogue.
I respect your program for.
Thank you. What their trip is and what our trip is exist in parallel universes of discourse, and the crossover, which is so necessary for democracy, the kind of town meeting model of the New England long ago.
I'm with you on that.
Is gone.
I think that's a wonderful model.
It's gone. And we all need to struggle to do it. That's why the city repair project, stuff like that.
Yeah.
In the end.
Even local.
In the end, the local stuff. That's why the neighborhood associations, even though they tend sometimes to be a little elitist, which is only because we don't go to the damn meetings, by the way, are very important. Building from the ground up is crucial. Awareness is crucial. Understanding history as it really is unfolding and not as some mythological system is crucial. And all of this, of course, is happening in a context where education is more and more contentless and skill-driven. Not that I'm against skill development. It's very important. And we, of course, on the other hand, are being amused to death by a media that presents violence, whether it's authorities
diversion.
Violence or vigilante violence. Violence is the solution to complex problems. It's a set of lies that are convenient, more worthy of a 10-year-old boy than they are of a mature adult of either sex. Anyway, thanks a lot for the call, man.
Thank you. Always.
All right. Take care. 231-8187. It's the 4th of July, and I am serious. I want to talk with you, and if you disagree with me, I really want to talk to you. Okay, 231-8187. Leah, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
I'm missing A, but I'm delighted to hear you.
Okay.
I was intrigued with your topic this morning. The other day on KBOO, the talk show was about adventures. And you wanted to hear from women. Well, I'm one of those.
I noticed that.
You also wanted to hear from people who disagree with you. And when I first heard you starting to talk, I did disagree with you. I said, no, I don't, I'm not agreeing with you, Joe.
Cool.
But unfortunately, I have to agree with a lot of what you're saying.
Can you lower your radio? We got this new system of necessity where we're delayed.
Is that better?
Yes, thank you.
I think, you know, you're talking about the economy, the neocons. I don't think people really understand how the neocons their agenda. Most people refer to themselves as Christian. The reality is that the neocons, the religious fundamentalists,
mm-hmm.
have an agenda that ignores the other people. In other words, if you're not part of their community, if you're not part of those who are going to be saved, then you are dispensable. The whole issue of the left behind thing is that's all about. It's like a brainwashing. It is, and it works on our fears. You know, Bush, the war, the neocons, the loss of our freedoms, the Patriot Act, the things that are going on in our courts, they are all distractions for us from focusing on what we need to be dealing with, which is what you quoted in the preamble to the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
That's where our energy needs to go. It is to understand that for the common good, that includes everybody.
Exactly.
Everybody. And there is a model out of Europe that has just come into the United States called sociocracy, and I believe
what is sociocracy?
Sociocracy is a model that came out of Denmark after the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
Denmark did not have the Marshall Plan, and they had to deal with the cost of the war and their society and all the devastation of, you know, what happened to them.
Uh-huh.
And they came up with a model of how develop a government, a system that would begin to meet people's needs at every level. And they had to find a way so that everybody, the lowest person on the bottom, had a voice in what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the sociocracy model is a system where people meet, like in the old New England communities, where
mm-hmm.
everybody talked.
Mm-hmm.
They choose a spokesperson, maybe one or two. Those people go to the next group above them and make their requests known and the needs and what people are thinking and what that group has talked about.
Mm-hmm.
They choose someone from that group and they move up until they finally get up to the top where decisions can be made. Then they make a decision, it goes back down to the bottom, and people go through the process again. It's working tremendously well. European countries are trying it. I believe Spain is one of the countries that's using it in their model businesses with worker-owned businesses.
You know, and that, I'm glad you mentioned that. There is no reason why cooperatives could not be profit-making and successful, and Scandinavia is a great model for that.
Yes, and Spain has incredible stuff going on over there.
Yeah.
I believe that we are in a place where we must choose a new form of government, and we have the right to do that. The Constitution says...
Well, what do you mean by a new form of government?
The form we have is not working. It doesn't meet people's needs. It doesn't allow people a voice, and that's one of the reasons people are opting out. They're jumping ship. It's just, I only have a vote. If you steal my vote, that's the only voice I have. And
mm-hmm.
that's what they're feeling. Now, that may not be the reality, but that's what they're feeling. And they walk away. They're sick of it. They don't, you know, they're people buy the votes, they steal the votes, they manipulate the votes, it's just...
Well, and the politicians, of course, have this strategy where they move to the left or right to gain their constituencies and then end up at the middle. And the middle, and I think you know this, has constantly, since FDR, moved to the right.
Yes. So when we get into our fears, we lose our objectivity. We don't see that we can make choices and find new strategies. We get caught in the same old patterns. You know, Franklin Roosevelt said our greatest fear is fear itself. Our greatest challenge is fear itself. That's what
actually he said the only fear we have, the only thing we have to fear is fear
itself. Yes.
Yeah.
But it's what's going on within me. It's like if I'm afraid of the Patriot Act or Bush or war or the terrorists, I stop thinking. It's like a freeze frame, and it traumatizes
Interesting.
People. So how do we get out of that? You know, to create strategies.
Well, we start with the little things.
Yes, you're right. So one of the little things that's happening, Portland's doing lots and lots of little things. And I just found out about sociocracy, and I'm in the process of starting a business that will utilize landfill paper to build a material for housing for people. It's called paper adobe.
Oh yeah, I just saw an article about that.
Yeah, and I'm going to incorporate the sociocracy method process into that,
mm-hmm.
so that it's everybody has a voice, and I think this is where we need to go. This is one of the new forms we need to come up with. So
yeah.
Anyway, that's my thought. This is a great program.
Well, sure.
I'm so delighted you keep talking about the Constitution. This, you know, we need to remember what it was that our forefathers gave us.
No, it's a great document. You know, it's not a perfect document, but it is modifiable. And modifiable in very positive ways.
Yeah.
I would never throw this baby out with the bathwater. Mm-hmm. I would add the first 10 amendments of this Constitution, particularly the First Amendment, all of them, are so very important. And what this administration, with its unitary presidency, is doing, as you know, is to destroy effectively all of the protections that make America, to the degree that it is free, a free nation.
Okay, I want to respond to that, because I've heard that, I keep hearing that.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, no, the Constitution is there. It's not been done away with. If we allow these people to do and say these things, if we do not resist, then effectively we've nullified the Constitution.
No, you're right. And
we need to do is stand up and say, no, who took away my rights? No, you didn't take away habeas corpus. It's not possible. You cannot do that. I am the people. You're the people. You don't have the right to do that. This is... You know, they don't have the right, but we have to resist. We have to say, no. And there are some prices to that. So one of the things we have to resist. Before I go, though, I want to tell you about a strategy I've come up with.
Okay.
I heard about this out of the 60s, came off of OPB here a while back. One of the things that someone did in the poverty marches, they were coming up with all these strategies, and one of them was somebody created this huge poster banner, and it said, wanted for vagrancy, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go do that.
Well, and I've been thinking about, you know, I always think about stuff that I've, as you know, urged people to write with chalk on the sidewalk.
Yes,
I don't know
yes.
how many people really do it. Some do.
I'm going to start doing it.
And I think it's very important. All you have to do is carry one of those big chalks, you know, and just wherever the hell you are, just write on the sidewalk. I doubt that it's illegal, but who cares? It'll be washed away.
But
also using the telephone poles, I want to make, simple posters. A picture of Bush and deliberately in the printing process, you know, do the thing we used to do to make fun of people. Put a funny mustache on him. Put a funny goatee on him. Put a little Hitler mustache, you know. But to constantly reinforce or deconstruct, I guess is the right word, the notion that these guys are legitimate rulers.
Yeah, and I think other thing we need to put out there is we need to put before people that this is a very injured soul, that he was badly damaged, and somehow we need to present him again as this little child who is, is being used himself. And I'm not sure how to do that.
That's an interesting problem.
Yeah.
But I think the first thing you have to do is get these people out of power. But I want to emphasize one thing about that. Focusing on the evil of Cheney or Bush misses the point about the structural changes that this administration has
Absolutely.
Put in place.
Yeah, it is
getting rid of those guys will not get rid of the problem.
Yes, it is the system itself that has to be changed.
Right.
Absolutely. And Walter Wink has written about this. He's an Episcopal theologian. Rion Eisler, I mean, people are talking about this, but now we have to stop talking and do it. We got to do it.
I think we can do it in everyday life. I think when you have an exchange at the supermarket, when you're talking with some fast food worker and saying, you know, I always find myself saying, man, I don't know how much you make, but I guess you get a profit share from this corporation, McDonald's, right? And no. I guess you get good health care benefits. Well, no. And then I say, I guess you need a union, huh?
Yeah.
And I let it go because, you know, the kid or the, sometimes it's an older person, has the opportunity there to mull it. And again, we never know where the tipping point is, the tipping point for bad or the tipping point for good.
Yeah, well, we're faced with a great adventure, and at any moment, it's going to hit. So it's like, so we just keep doing it one step at a time.
And the other aspect of it, which, by the way, I want to praise Al Gore's movie, Inconvenient Truth, in this context, another measure, which is very, very important, is to realize that we are in a race against the planet's ability to shrug off us the virus that is harming it.
Yes, and it can do it, and there's evidence that it's done it before.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know about humans, but it's done it before, period.
We are expendable.
Oh, yeah.
We are very expendable.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks,
we are
Joe.
Smart, but not smart enough.
Yeah.
All right, thanks for the
Joe.
Call.
Okay.
Great. 231-8187. It is July 4th. We are celebrating America. We are talking about the role of the government and what should it be. I'm citing the preamble to the Constitution of the United States, which clearly states that the purpose of establishing this Constitution is to promote the general welfare. Do not forget that. Anyone who doesn't understand that about our system of government misses the point. Government, that is the power of the state, is always dangerous in any society. Its only justification lies in its ability to guarantee freedoms, to protect us, and to support us and provide us with general welfare. General welfare is not a military figure. 231-8187, you're listening to KBO. I'm Joe Uris, and you're Ralph, and you're on the air.
Hey, right arm, Joe.
Right arm! I love that expression.
There's so many points, but if one was to take a sweeping view of the history of the U.S., there are vast periods of unrest and vast areas of economic unfairness. Going back, you've got, you know, the majority of people at the time didn't really want to kick the British out, but once the fighting started, they had to pick sides.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's, by the way, true in any of these kind of revolutionary situations. I think most Vietnamese, for example, really just wanted everybody to go away and be able to do their farms and raise their families and live their lives.
Yeah. And we, you know, then the whole history of displacing the native peoples that were here.
Oh, yeah.
All the ethnic fighting that went on when, vast migration came in with the Italians and the Irish and the Jewish immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, the notion that the U.S. has been some happy, homogenous country, and now it's just facing some sort of real different era. I think we're just going back to an area. If you remember World War II, there was so much industry that was destroyed in Japan and China and in Europe that the U.S. really was the only viable place to do much of the manufacturing after World War II, and so I think that's what generated a middle class in America and raised a lot of people in an expectation that was going to continue. But once that ability to manufacture has gone into a global situation, and you see that the wealth, concentration of wealth again is, mm-hmm. has reached almost crisis proportions, because that's the way capitalism works.
Well, yeah, in fact, here's the odd thing that I think about a lot. Everyone has kind of dismissed Marx because the expression of Marxism was the so-called socialism of China and the so-called socialism of Russia. But the reality is that if you really read Marx, even the Communist Manifesto, which everybody should read, not because they need to believe it, but they need to read it and think about it, what Marx is really saying is the ubiquitousness, the overwhelming power of the ability of the market system of capitalism to provide material goods is so overwhelming that it creates a world culture of consumption. And he doesn't use the word consumption, but it's there, 1848. Very prescient, very brilliant piece of work. And everyone needs to really appreciate that. That needs to be balanced by the interests of the ordinary individual and by the interests of the environment itself. Capitalism untrammeled is a system which inevitably leads to monopolies and oligopolies and kleptocracies, you know what I mean, and ultimately leads to the destruction not just of the environment, but of humanity itself.
Exactly, and I think, you know, what you mentioned about changing the people that are pretending to have the uniforms on and that are supposedly running the ship of state, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
Doesn't do anything. These people are long-time civil or public servants, or kind of pseudo-public servants, but they have you know, I guess the American ruling class likes to stay behind the scenes. You don't even, you can't even hardly name anyone except for the obvious, you know, David Rockefeller, those kinds of people that you can name. But most of them you can't even name. And they, because of their, our system has gotten to the point where you have to have millions of dollars to be able to even consider becoming a senator or running for president.
Well, you have to go to the rich boys to get the money, which then makes you in debt to the rich boys that you got the money from.
Yeah, so
and girls.
It all comes back to the money system. That I think, you know, that you can make some changes to the government. Some of the laws obviously are fairly restricting because again, as the middle class starts to be weaned out, you know, they want to make sure that they have enough jail space and all that crap. But you know, the, it all comes down to the money, and that's a very difficult fight. I don't really have a good solution.
It
for
is
that,
a difficult fight.
People being aware of what's going on.
It becomes even more difficult as we are deliberately being persuaded that our Social Security system won't help us. We are deliberately being screwed over in our Medicare, Medicaid system. We are deliberately, and these are not accidents, we are deliberately not getting the services we need in national disasters. It's, I believe, the deliberate effort to transfer the power of government from the service of the, to the people, the welfare, the general welfare of the public, to the hands of the very smallest element of really opportunistic capitalism, together with essentially a military-industrial congressional complex that basically calls the tune in the interest of a system that less and less cares about individual freedom or individual opportunity. And by the way, having all those freedoms when you don't have a lot of opportunities economically and so on doesn't work either. We need to open our educational systems. We need to make our people literate and aware. And we need to provide a healthy environment. And we all need to demand that in every context in our lives. This is a very real struggle. It will go on for a very long time. It is not clear. I don't believe in the notion that history is progressive, which is one of the things I disagree with Marx about. We do not know the outcome. It is all up for grabs. It is our responsibility, existentially, that is morally, and in terms of anything ever happening that's good. It's our responsibility to make it happen. We all of us need to devote a thoughtful 8 hours a week at least to the struggle to make a better world.
I totally agree, and I think another thing that we need to find some breakthrough on, and again, this is difficult, but I think there are technologies out there that allow you to become more independent and to break the chain of control. I think that's why you see oil continue to be the only viable energy put out there, because it's able to be controlled. If we had, say, a source of electricity that you could almost generate on your own, you don't need the man anymore.
Well, in many places you could, if you could find a way to afford the initial investment. See, that's the thing, for example, that stops me. You know, I can't, I really don't have the money to build my own off-the-grid electrical system. And there are systems now evolving that will allow more and more of that. But in each case, in each example that you or I could cite, we can see that there is a way out of the jam we're in. But there's legislation, that essentially makes it hard for us to do it. There's a government that is turning away from helping us to do it. And essentially, most important of all, there is a growing difference, a developing class structure that I personally never would have guessed if you'd asked me about it, say, in the 1960s or 70s. And the rich, and that's a small number, get richer, and the poor get poorer, and the middle class sinks slowly into the situation of poverty and debt.
I think, you know, one thing that comes to my mind is back in the era of these little city-state...
You mean like Greece?
Yeah, where you just kind of become your own little island, and I think you might have to, we might have to get to that point where we're just kind of Portlandia, and we find ways to take care of ourselves and establish something so that we are able to maintain something, and we can provide a beacon of light that says, you know, we've got something going here.
Right.
And, you know, the national government is important, but let's focus on making this place viable and you know, let's put the wall around it if we have to.
No walls, no walls.
Well, I mean, in a
no, I know, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I mean, we could make a nice, pretty wall that everybody could contribute to, but maybe a
Himalayan blackberry wall.
Maybe a garden, you know, a giant garden around Portland.
But I will say this: there is a theory which has been around for a long time, which argues essentially that the way you develop economic, political states that are viable is you look to the natural watershed environment. For example, then you have this kind of Cascadia model. Now, those are utopian ideas which may eventually evolve out of the present situation. But if we keep in mind not the ability to actually make that, but the ability to look toward the elements of that, you know, if everyone, for example, took a piece of land, I'm talking about 4 feet by 8 feet, and cultivated their own fresh greens, for example. If everybody went to the farmer's market, to the independent grower, if everybody attempted as much as they can to reduce their consumption of the unnecessary, I'm not denying people luxury here, but to reduce the consumption of the unnecessary, to resist the mall and the mauling of America, we would already begin to be making a serious, significant, and positive impact, not only on the economic system, but on the environmental structure as well. Don't you
right,
think?
Right arm, Joe. I'll
right
let
arm.
Get on there.
Okay, man, I'll give others opportunity.
All right.
Thanks a lot for the call. Are we having fun yet? I think so. It's July 4th. Cannons going off. Fingers being blown away. Great opportunities. I'm going to get to James in a moment, but first I have to tell you that at 9 o'clock on Between the Covers here at KBOO 90.7 FM, the guest is Barbara Saranella, author of An Unacceptable Death, a crime novel set in 1980s L.A. Enough said. In 9:30 on Black Book Talk, the guest is writer and actor Perry Gaffney, author of The Resurrection of Alice, a novel inspired by the countless forgotten lives of young black girls who were married by parental arrangement to men old enough to be their grandfathers. Wow. And at 10, we'll hear about 826, a local organization devoted to helping young people develop their creative writing skills. Good idea. At 10:15, hear an award-winning documentary produced by journalist Sandy Tolan. It's called The Lemon Tree, and it's the story of a simple act of faith between a Palestinian and an Israeli that symbolizes hope for peace in the Middle East. And at 11, my favorite show, the show I want to move till 9 o'clock, Democracy Now! It's a holiday special featuring StoryCorps, a national social history project that records ordinary people telling their stories to each other, which is really a great idea. It's kind of Studs Terkel taken to the local level. It's good stuff. It's important. It's on KBOO. And I want to add one other thing. I don't mention this enough, and I should. We have the best, and I mean this, music programming of any broadcast station anywhere. I mean, we got it all. And you all should be paying more attention to it because it's great. This is the place on the dial you want to be every day, almost all the time. 90.7 FM, KBOO. All right. Now, who do we got? James, my man.
Yeah.
How are ya?
I'm patient.
Well, that's good. You're on the air.
Oh, cool.
You've been rewarded, I guess.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah. I'm going to be brief, but, you know, I've seen a lot of my freedom slip away.
Yes. Is that it? That's it?
Yeah, here I am. I turned off the TV.
Okay, so you've seen your freedom slip away, and?
And, you know, I can't believe it. I was born in 1950. And, you know,
I feel like singing, I was born in the USA, a song much misunderstood by the Republicans, by the way.
Oh, absolutely.
It's our song, not theirs.
Well, you know, it's just ridiculous. You could do anything as long as you didn't destroy anything or harm anybody. You could just have your freedom.
Well, you could do anything except step on my Belushi shoes.
Well, that's right.
Sorry,
that's
sorry, sorry. Just a little random stupidness. Go ahead.
Well, yeah. Well, I just see this administration, you know, marching away like Hitler, and it's a very parallel thing. They invaded the wrong country.
Yeah. Well, Hitler invaded the right country because he got away with it until he hit the Russians.
Well, you
never
know.
Never mind. Go ahead. I'm just yeah.
the national product.
Yeah.
You know. The wealth of this country
right.
has gone for missiles and anti-missile missiles all through my lifetime.
Well, isn't that interesting? You know, actually, if I think about my life, I was born just at the start of World War II. I'm going to tell you how old I am. Just at the start of World War II, and essentially a little before the start and for America. And essentially, I have never lived in America that wasn't a military-industrial complex.
Yeah, well, I'm a baby boomer. I was just born, you know, right after the war.
Yeah, same difference, really.
Well, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But
I try to imagine. You know, I grew up in San Diego. I try to imagine, which was in those days less a tourist town than it is today. It was mainly the manufacturing at Convair. Consolidated, you know, General Dynamics, right? General Dynamics, the building of various jet aircraft of all sorts to make war, and the development of all kinds of weapon systems, and of course, it was the center of the Marine Corps and the Navy. So
sure
it was,
not.
You know,
Coronado.
It was the world I grew up in, and it was a world that was so assumedly right wing that the John Birch Society was considered just a reasonable element of the right. Just the most extreme element of the then right wing.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just a scary prospect what everything's going to.
Yeah, but it's also fun. You know, what's neat about it is, and I keep using the word existential, hoppy-toppy, fancy-schmancy word, but what's neat about it is when you dare to struggle, you dare to win.
You have to.
And that's old Mao Zedong, of all people. And it's really important to appreciate the possibilities that history offers, as opposed to the inevitabilities that doom and gloom take over in our minds and make us, and really paralyze us and make it impossible for us to take the actions and be brave, the things that we very much need to do in this time.
I'm too old to be scared.
Hey, cool.
You are too, I imagine.
No, I'm a neurotic. I'm scared. I worry about crossing the street. You know what I mean?
Mm. Well, watch out for the bus.
Yeah, the big bus. Okay, listen, I appreciate the call, man.
Okay, well, you know, that's just, you know, the only thing I wanted to broadcast is that this administration is tearing this country apart.
Well, and I want to emphasize something I said earlier. Unfortunately, we are a nation really of three constituencies. The bulk of people have no faith in the system, don't give a damn, hope to make the nut, are terrified in their lives, and don't participate in the political system. The people on the right, many of whom are deluded Christian fundamentalists, not teaching and preaching the love of Jesus, but teaching and preaching the wrath of a cruel God who wants to end time. That's one element. The left element, which is more diverse and more confused in some ways, and not coherent exactly, wanting, I think, by and large, social democracy, believing in vast conspiracies, and convinced, which they're not wrong about necessarily, and convinced of the necessity of some kind of radical change, but without a language and a process and even a theory and certainly a practice, you know, praxis, that can
well,
bring
one,
that about.
Just one thing I'd like to say is that why doesn't all this money contribute to the United States instead of, you know, building firehouses in Iraq and, you know.
Well, you know, that's I agree with you. But the question of whether or not we should be generous is a different question than whether or not we should dominate the world. The two are very different issues.
Mm.
I would not be opposed. First of all, I think, you know, what we did in Iraq from the very beginning was horrible and awful and cruel and inhumane. And what we continue to do, including, it turns out, rapes and so forth and so on, what we continue to do is awful. And we got to get the hell out of there, which I think is going to be very hard to do. And it's going to be a real mess and no matter how we go with it. But I think that it's really important. It's really important that we appreciate that share the wealth, which is an old line from Huey Long in Louisiana. sharing the wealth, not necessarily not creating wealth through private enterprise, but sharing that wealth is very important. A lot of criticism about the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the decisions.
Can't criticize them.
I can't at all. I think that,
they've
stopping
built libraries
malaria
in Seattle. Yes. You know, they contribute to AIDS foundations.
Absolutely. Stopping malaria, stopping AIDS, building a healthy world, creating school systems, making the world a better place when you've earned a huge amount of money.
They've got more money than God. They can't, you know, they can't spend it.
Yeah,
so it's a good thing.
It's a good thing. And I know there's criticism of it. I see in The Nation that there's been some criticism of the choices of how they give their money. Some people would prefer them to give it to a political effort to change the country. I think that's a very different process. And I get nervous even when wealth, vast wealth, is used for good causes. I think the precedent therein is very, very dangerous. So I really do appreciate the possibility, and this is important, of there being honorable, good, serious, responsible, socially, socially responsible individuals who will share their wealth in appropriate ways to make the world a better place. It gives me some hope against the overwhelming tide of extreme selfishness that grips this nation. Anyway, thanks for the call, man.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we kind of cut him down. Sorry if we cut you off a little early, but, you know, we did. And we got lots of callers. 231-8187. I'm Joe Uris. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. It is talk radio. It is July 4th. We're talking about George Lakoff's argument that Bush, never mind his personal incompetence, that his administration is not incompetent, that it has achieved virtually every one of its goals, including strangling the government in the bathtub of small and petty expenditure, transferring wealth from the people through the government and the tax structure, transferring it into the hands of the very, very, very wealthy of a certain sort, not just any very wealthy, but of a certain sort, and in that process convincing all of us not to have any faith in a public system, that is, in the government, and thereby setting us up for a kind of libertarian model which ignores the power of monopoly capital and the military industrial state. And I want to add the beautiful pieces by Jane Mayer, I guess it is, in The New Yorker, and of all places in the U.S. News and World Report of May 29th, talking about James Addington, Cheney's chief of staff. The unitary presidency, the idea that the President of the United States, never mind the division of powers into three branches, but the unitary president in a time of emergency can do anything he wants. Which means Cheney gets to do anything he wants. 231-8187. Who do we got? Ed.
Hey, Joe. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
I touched that Liberty Bell and saw that Liberty Hall a lot of times in Philly, man, growing up.
That's great.
And Valley Forge.
Yeah.
That's like, hey, it's going to be a tough struggle, but you keep on, man.
I agree. I absolutely agree.
A lot of us are bruised, battered, and scarred by and hard by now to the system. We've been through a lot of battles, but we just keep rising back up, man.
Yeah,
that's
exactly
the only way we can live.
Absolutely. And you know what's cool in a very petty kind of way? You meet the nicest boys and girls when you're out there. You really do, whether they're 80 or 18. You meet them. You greet them, you find friendships in common, you build community, and the struggle becomes inherent in that community you're building.
Hey, I know we had the battle won at the test site when the blue-haired ladies and the surfers and the skateboarders were heading over the line together, man, to stop nuclear testing.
That's right. That's a very good example. A beautiful
and the guards
example.
Were joining us, too.
No, I think that actually, if you have a chance to have a conversation with most people... And
no, they actually did come and join our ranks, man.
Oh, that's great.
They quit working for Wackenhut, some of them, and they hooked up with us.
I didn't know that. That's wonderful.
Hey, a book to read, Richard Evans's Inside the Third Reich,
1933
to 1939.
Huh.
Talks about how, like, you know, the state of emergencies, like you talked about around the Reichstag, the purging of the SA, how they got into the churches and leaned on the judges. And the German people said, how did things change so fast? We just got out of the Weimar Republic, and now we're into this?
Well, I think you're making a very good point. I think
and people should read it and review it and see the methods. I'm surprised Richard Colbert's not walking the streets, because, like, you couldn't make jokes about Hitler. You'd get thrown in jail.
Well, one of the great things about this country, you know, is its long tradition, which has evolved, because it wasn't always that strong. I mean, in the 1919, for example, 1918, people were being thrown in jail for exercising their free speech rights. But we have it. We have evolved. The courts would like to go back to the 1880s or something. But we now have the opportunity to speak out. The question is, how do we use it? We use it by making sure a radio station like this is strong and healthy. We use it by making sure that when, you know, when we have $5 to throw together, we make our own damn poster on our own damn computer, and we slap it up wherever we can. And when we don't have that, we take a piece of chalk and we write on the sidewalk. And
trade those tomato seeds with your neighbor, you know?
Exactly, exactly. It's at the local level.
Trade that extra vegetables with your neighbor.
Absolutely. It's at the level of every aspect of our lives, where we share, where we work together, where we argue, and where we struggle against this overwhelming danger. And we can do it. We can do it.
That's the next book, Garbage Land. Now, the lady actually weighed all her trash and sorted it by type.
Yeah.
And it really opened her eyes. Like, she actually went, like, she was in New York, went into Brooklyn, a transfer station, rode the truck way out into Pennsylvania or New York, further out into, or West Virginia, where they would dump trash.
Oh, yeah.
To see actually what was being, and it really said, hey, I should be riding my bike more. I should be going to my local farmer's market. I don't need all this packaging. Why should I be eating fast food? You know what I mean?
I understand perfectly, and I think it's a great... I think one of the things that's happening, and unfortunately we are not communicating so effectively with our right-wing friends, one of the things that is happening is that we are, all of us, becoming more and more aware of our ways, the multitude of ways in which we can be responsible citizens and prosper thereby. It's really important.
Yeah, and you're back to the root, because that's really how they resisted the British a lot, by refusing to trade with them and being more self-sufficient.
You know, one of the interesting things is that there are issues which we, that is the left in general, liberals to radicals, have in common with a lot of authentically conservative people. And that commonality is hidden by the issues of taxation and the issues of the role of government and so on. It needs to be brought to the fore so the discussion can be real. I honestly think that that's one of the key factors. And one of my problems is, personal problems, this is not your problem, I love working at KABU, but I'm talking to people who are already pretty much where I'm at. I wish, frankly, I was doing commercial radio on some right-wing station and getting lambasted by all those people, just taking them on.
Exactly.
Anyway, take care.
So there it is, Joe. That's my input for today.
I appreciate it. Happy birthday.
I'll see you.
Happy birthday. Happy birthday. Happy birthday. July 4th is your day, so have a lot of fun. Boom. Tom, you're on the air.
Hey, terrific. Joe, normally your day is Tuesday. How wonderful to have you. My God, this is a Tuesday.
It is. It is a Tuesday.
Listen.
Amazing. Came right after a Monday, yeah.
Number one.
Yeah.
Page 8, New York Times, Week in Review, Sunday's paper. You got to read it. America and Israel, a troubling alliance.
Uh-huh.
And somebody that I happen to know has put on their computer this website, GOPBias.com, and they've got the same thing. It's a huge issue, and it's one that you ought to be familiar with, because this is something called the Council for National Interest, and it's right down your line.
Okay. I don't know anything about it, but okay.
Have you, you have access to the Sunday New York Times?
I have access, yes.
The Week in Review section?
Okay.
Page 8 of that Week in Review section?
All right. All right. Actually, I think I have it right here. Let me see.
Good. Take a look at it and tell your many listeners about it. And God, it's good to hear you. And I endorse all of us that are celebrating. This is our 230th. We're still the greatest nation on earth. We've just got a bit of a problem in the White House. Let's get rid of them.
Well, it's interesting. Actually, the article you're referring to is not an article. It's a big full-page ad. You know that.
Pardon me?
The thing you're referring to is a big full-page ad, which I have not read.
Yeah. Well, you got to read it because it's the only full-page ad I've ever seen in Week in Review, and there are a few things to say in favor of the New York Times, but this is one of them.
Of course, I always want to know who exactly is the council, you know, or any organization, Council for the National Interest Foundation.
Well, this council was organized by two, I think, although they're Republicans, they were responsible Republicans. Mm. Paul Findlay, Republican from Illinois, and Pete McCloskey. You remember Pete McCloskey from California?
Sure.
He was one of those, very strongly opposed to Nixon and whatever.
Well, let me read the piece. I don't want to make any comment about it until I've really had a chance
to
look at it.
Right, well, and okay? Those of us that are listening, we can read it as well.
And I think it's good that you suggested it, because all kinds of discussion is awfully important.
Absolutely.
Thanks for the call,
Happy
man.
Birthday.
Happy birthday. Happy birthday. Yes, I wish we had fireworks. Oh, there's fireworks. There will be fireworks. 231-8187, you're listening to KBOO. I'm Joe Uris. This is Talk Radio, and you're Steve.
Hey, thanks. I want to say even the liberal Democrat icon FDR oversaw dictatorships being installed in Cuba, Haiti, and Nicaragua during the 30s.
Oh, yeah.
The United States has a history of unabated imperialism internationally since 1898. Continues on to this day.
Well, I would add the Spanish War. I mean the Mexican War to that.
Yeah,
also, or for that matter, the taking over of Native American cultures. You know.
Absolutely. So.
Or the stealing of all of those African people and bringing them here. You know, we're not angels.
Well, we're citizens of an international outlaw, and the only reason it continues to exist is because nobody else has been strong enough to take it down. So, what are we celebrating?
Well, we're celebrating the This is a good question. You're actually really asking a good question. We're celebrating the possibilities that are represented by a constitutional system of government that, under ideal conditions, can deliver a great deal to the people, including that ephemeral item, freedom. That's what we're celebrating.
Which has been meted out in dosages which don't threaten the status quo.
I agree. On the other hand, you know, it's kind of neat that even though we don't have good candidates to vote for, we do have the opportunity to vote.
Which, if anybody who really threatened the status quo ever actually won the election, we'd see how much that counts, right?
Well, I'm with you there. I think we are in serious trouble. I have often said we are in proto-fascist system. But I think it is not lost. I think America is worth saving. I think that we cannot, by the way, reach out to many people if our politics insist on demanding that we beat ourselves up all the time. Not that we're not critical of ourselves, but we also must be able to talk of the virtues or the potential virtues of this unique republic. Hey, man, I'm running out of time.
Okay, thanks.
I want to thank you very much. I hope everybody enjoyed it. Enjoy the glorious 4th for what it is. And remember the preamble of the United States Constitution, which says clearly, that we are to provide domestic tranquility and that we are... and that we are to have a common defense, and that we are to promote the general welfare of the people. That is what America is about. And freedom, democracy, the first 10 amendments of the Constitution, and all that came thereafter, creating more and more opportunities for more and more people. It can be done. We do not want to abandon it. It is an interesting and potentially great nation. Stay tuned for wonderful programming on KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland 90.7. Welcome to the Tuesday Morning Radio Zine. First on Between the Covers, the guest is Barbara Serinella, author of An Unacceptable Death, a crime novel set in 1980s Los Angeles. At 9:30 on Black Book Talk, the guest is writer and actor Perry Gaffney, author of The Resurrection of Alice, a novel inspired by the countless forgotten lives of young black girls who were married by parental arrangement to men old enough to be their grandfathers. At 10, we'll hear about 826, a national organization devoted to helping young people develop their creative writing skills. At 10:15, hear an award-winning documentary produced by journalist Sandy Tolan. It's called The Lemon Tree, and it's the story of a simple act of faith between a Palestinian and an Israeli that symbolizes hope for peace in the Middle East. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, it's a holiday special featuring StoryCorps, a national social history project that records ordinary people telling their stories to each other.